be subject to the anti-terrorism and effective death penalty act. So we're bound by the facts. And we could have done the facts that Mr. Lambert was advised to the council. The council would be appointed for him there for that time to restore counsel, that he could be given additional time to consider the matter, reflect on it, consult the council, that he denied, well, refused the opportunity to be represented and wanted to resolve the matter right that day and pleaded guilty.
Isn't the real question here whether he understood the 1958 proceeding? Well, then, what is there in the record that would allow us to disregard the credibility determination of Judge Georgetta's testimony that he did understand the nature of the proceedings?
I believe that Judge Georgetta, first of all, applied the wrong standard in the sense that he was presuming that Mr. Lane understood. Under von Moltke versus Gilly, the case that I recently brought to the court about, he was required to conduct a penetrating and comprehensive inquiry to make the determination affirmatively to determine whether he voluntarily and intelligently was waiving his right to counsel.
You're talking about the 58 hearing, or are you talking about the evidentiary hearing?
I was answering Brown's question about the 1958 proceeding.
Well, no, but there was an evidentiary hearing.
Oh, I understand.
Which went into all that.
Absolutely.
And resolved the issue. And I thought that was Judge Nelson's question.
Indeed. He, at the evidentiary hearing, Judge Georgetta said that he felt that your client understood the nature of the proceedings. Now, that's the key to this case. All right. And why don't we credit that?
In order to understand the testimony, one has to go back and look at the circumstances in 1958. And what...
Well, yes, and...
Well, based on his 1972 testimony, it's apparent to Mr. Leyva that the standard that the judge was looking at was that he was presuming that Mr. Leyva was voluntarily and intelligently waiving his right to counsel. And I'd like to address the specifics of how I arrived at that conclusion. Rather than conducting that inquiry, what the judge did was that he presumed that Mr. Lane was intelligently waiving his rights because he had a number of juvenile court contacts. But he also testified in 1972 that a defendant with only juvenile court experience would be ill-prepared to understand what was happening in his court. So therefore, his assumption that Mr. Lane understood is really invalid because, again, he said that somebody with that experience wouldn't understand what was happening in his court. The judge knew that Mr. Leyva had extensive dealings with the district attorney, and that the district attorney told him that he was going to plead guilty. This was a cut-and-dry case. It would only take a few minutes of his time. Therefore, his inquiry was geared to that. And the judge in 1972 said, well, I assume that he had a preliminary examination, again, assuming that he understood the nature of the allegations against him. Mr. Lane waived his freedom after signing the form that he most likely couldn't read because the evidence was uncontested that he was illiterate. We certainly agree that the evidence establishes it's clear that Mr. Lane did understand English. And the testimony from 1972 from his probation officer and things like that, he understood that before proceedings were done against him, the juvenile court, which again is what Judge Georgetta was basing in significant part of Mr. Lane's understanding, everything was patiently explained to him in words that he could understand. And that was Mr. Nelson's testimony, that I used words that he could understand. Judge Georgetta read from a set form. Use terms like employing counsel, if you don't have the funds. And clearly the court found that he had been advised. The judge assumed that Mr. Leyva understood and attempted to what was going on because he was polite in court and said, no, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, stood up at an appropriate time. And plus, Mr. Leyva didn't object to those proceedings and seemed eager to resolve them. And like the decision in Michigan versus Moore, the Nevada State Court of that evidentiary hearing didn't really give effect to the threats of the capital punishment against Mr. Leyva and why he seemed so eager to resolve the matter that day. And in Moore, the Supreme Court concluded that the defendant wasn't entering an intelligent waiver because of these threats, trouble, and the potential of a lynch mob. And the U.S. Supreme Court gave effect to that in terms of finding whether his waiver was intelligent, but the Nevada State Court didn't. Judge Georgetta did. And perhaps Judge Georgetta wasn't aware of it, like the judge in Michigan versus Moore, which was certainly listed in the 1972 hearing, and that judge didn't give any instruction about it.
See, all of that would be more, far more compelling if there had not been an evidentiary hearing at which the very identical issue was presented and resolved.
Absolutely. I think one of the considerations, Your Honor, was that the defendant in 1972 was a vastly different individual than he was in 1958.
Well, yeah, and presumably today he's even more vastly different.
Absolutely.
From that. But, I mean, the point is there was a full evidentiary hearing at which he testified, the judge testified, anybody else could have testified, and a state court made a fact-finding.
They did. And the fact-finding was that his understanding of English was better than he claimed. But, again, the uncontroverted evidence there was that the juvenile court proceeding wouldn't have prepared him to understand what was going on in the judge or judge's court. The judge assumed, because he
which the judge said he fully recognized and appreciated that the proceedings were different animals.
Well, that was the judge's certainly after the fact finding. That was his certainly his after the fact testimony.
You just want a different after the fact determination. I mean, the point is there was one.
I don't see how we're here, quite honestly. You're really challenging the validity of a 1958 conviction. Yeah, and there was and that was challenged in state court in the 60s and 70s, and there was a hearing.
Through the California state court proceedings, the evidence that there had been a 1972 evidentiary hearing wasn't brought forth. As part of the, once we were in federal court and we were in a discovery.
Well, is the 1958 conviction still open to challenge in the state court now?
It is absolutely because it's not affected by Lackawanna because
that's my question.
That you have a Gideon issue here because he had no counsel at all as opposed to an ineffective system.
And that remains, the Gideon issue remains even though there were proceedings in 1972.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. That's the one exception to Lackawanna is the absence of counsel.
Let me just ask you.
Yes,
is there any indication either in the 58 proceedings or the 72 proceedings that anyone explained to your client the consequences of pleading guilty or the nature of the punishment he faced?
None whatsoever. The judge indicated that he failed to advise Mr. Leyva because he had no statutory option. Mr. Leyva, at the time, was facing a crime subject to capital punishment. And all that was told to him was that he better plead guilty or he would be gassed to serve. And that was something that was well accepted. He hadn't been advised of that.
He was threatened as in Moore. Is this very similar to the Moore case then?
It's very similar. I believe that Moore is controlling. And essentially,
What?
He didn't understand the consequences.
Can you just tell me what? Because Judge Nelson's ahead of me here. What exactly was the challenge in the 72 proceedings?
That he didn't knowingly and intelligently waive his right to counsel because he didn't adequately understand the English language, and they also factored in the fact that he had been threatened.
Okay, and your position is that the Gideon is still that the Gideon exception is still applicable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that would like to reserve.
Okay. You may. You have about 30 seconds. We'll give you a minute.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Brian Smiley from the Attorney General's Office this afternoon. I'm representing the warden in this case. The Court has asked the parties to be prepared to discuss more sufficient hours to cut back to that case because that's going to be fairly important. I do agree that it has certain similarities with the current case, but I think there's...
Would you speak up, please?
I'm sorry. I do agree that there are some similarities between Roe v. Michigan and the Easton case. However, I do believe that the most crucial facts upon which Justice Brenner relied and really wrote Roe v. Michigan are not present in this case. And for that reason, specifically what has already been mentioned, that the fact that in Roe v. Michigan, the 17-year-old defendant... this young black man in the South accused of killing an elderly white woman and he was informed by the sheriff that there was a lynch mob outside. And the sheriff said, I don't know if I can protect you. You know, don't plead guilty if you're not guilty, but if you do plead not guilty, I can't guarantee your safety.
How does that differ from the sheriff saying a young, illiterate youth saying, unless you plead guilty, you're going to get gassed?
Well, the premise of that question that the sheriff said that, I totally disagree with. That is only based on the self-serving testimony of the defendant. Unlike Morris, Michigan, where there was corroborating evidence from the sheriff that, in fact, there had been, that he told the defendant that the lynch mob outside, we have no corroboration for that statement whatsoever. There was no evidence to use the 1972 state evidentiary hearing to suggest that, yes, he was, in fact, told he was going to be gassed for certain if he didn't plead guilty.
Is there any evidence at the 1972 hearing that Leyva knew the consequences of pleading guilty or the nature of the punishment? Because as I read Georgetta, he said, I didn't really tell him about the sentencing. Did anybody else tell him at any time? Or is there any evidence in 58 or 72?
As far as the record indicates, Your Honor, on the right track, that there was no specific admission telling him that your anticipated sentence will be 5 years to life. I don't believe that there's any support record for that. However, the record does indicate that the defendant admitted that he knew that he was facing 5 charges, including attempted murder and kidnapping. He knew that there was a potential of the death penalty for all those charges, conceivably, however unlikely it might have been, I don't know, but conceivably, under the law in Nevada at that time, he could actually be subject to the death penalty. And he knew he was getting a substantial benefit, the dismissal of those serious charges and one or two other charges, by pleading to the rape. He actually got a sentence of 5 years of life, and he was paroled after 5 years. So there wasn't specific, he wasn't specifically told me there was going to be a what sentence would be, he knew he was getting a sentence. And then another contrast in Morris, Michigan, where the defendant in that case had absolutely no benefit.
Well, the fact that he eventually got the benefits, I think, is not, doesn't go to the question of whether he knowingly and intelligently waived his rights.
That's one of the points that Justice Brennan pointed out in the majority opinion. And it did indicate that he didn't know what was going on, the defendant in Morris, Michigan. He was complaining that he had queer sensations in his head and he needed to be examined. There was obviously a hint there that he had a potential insanity. There's no such indication in this case. The lynch mob, as I pointed out, I don't think the lynch mob, there's no equivalent in this case. Leyva's unsupported assertion that he was totally going to be gassed for certain was found not credible by the Nevada State for their insurance impliedly, because they resolved the credibility issue in favor of Judge Bernadette. I agree that.
But George Georgetta, we didn't comment on that at all.
That's why I say quietly, because they were finding credibility, they were making credibility determinations vis-a-vis Leyva on one side and George Georgetta on the other. They clearly resolved and they explicitly found.
Well, those were two different issues, though. George Georgetta was just saying, I think he understood. It had nothing to do with whether or not the statement about you're going to be gassed if you don't plead guilty.
It does to the extent that Leyva was basing that solely on his own credibility, because as I said, it was not corroborated by any other.
I thought that we had Gideon in all of these cases in order to avoid having to do exactly what we're doing here, and the all of the Boykin involved, Rule 11 and all of this. To determine whether or not a plea is voluntarily entered, I'm still not quite understanding why the 1972 proceeding didn't take care of it, and why more we're still arguing more now, other than the fact that we asked you to.
Well, the disbar condition was used to enhance the sentence, obviously.
You see, the point is, you know, there's an evidentiary hearing in state court. Why doesn't they just end it?
Yeah.
I think,
okay, I mean, but that's your view, right?
Yes.
Okay, then you can argue yourself out of that position.
Yeah. I thought that's what you were doing.
But the point is, it ends it.
I was leading him on. I'll
put this one. Well, I said which way the wind's blowing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to follow the primrose path myself. obviously, since my time is very brief here, it was Michigan versus Gore. It wasn't the case from the South. So in terms of the Lynch model, the court found that the Lynch law wasn't real.
Well, look, the key thing is just what I just got through saying. I mean, Moore's on the books, so are a zillion other things on the books, including Gideon. But you had an evidentiary hearing in state court, which didn't exist in Moore. It was a motion for a new trial. Here you had an evidentiary hearing that resolved the identical issue.
Because of all the decisions that happened in the interim.
But when we went to state court again, no one knew about the evidentiary hearing. That was discovered during the discovery.
What does that have to do with the price of eggs?
Well, that's why we got into federal court, was because we didn't know about the evidentiary hearing.
Just help me. I'm missing a. Why does that matter? That nobody knew about it.
Because of our factual findings at the evidentiary hearing, it's argued that that decision was objectively unreasonable under those facts deduced because of, again, the effects of the threats. And we believe that the abuse.
Okay, but that doesn't. That's just because you think it's unreasonable. It's not that you didn't somehow know about it.
I'm sorry.
I don't know. You just got through saying it somehow mattered that nobody knew about the evidentiary hearing?
It was first elicited in federal court in terms of how it got into federal court was that no one knew about the hearing. All we knew
well, that's why the government is there to...
Yes.
Right. So, to
that
litigate.
That was subsequently discovered in federal court. So.
Yeah. So?
Well,
so now we know about it.
Well, and I believe that we should still be here even if that case would have been discovered earlier because, again... We believe that the decision was objectively unreasonable. The judge here said, well, he's not innocent, so therefore there's no harm, no foul here.
Okay.
And we believe there's more of an inquiry. The defendant Moore was clearly guilty, but that gave the Supreme Court no cause.
I think we do understand your
thank you.
Thank
you. I just want to say, in terms of the corroboration of the threats, that was corroborated by the judge that knew a little before.
That's fine. We understand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case just argued is submitted for decision. We'll hear the next case, Hightower versus Filer.